Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today's podcast is going to be amazing. This is going to be Secrets of Menopause. And we have an expert with us. It's Dr. Mary Claire Haver. She is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and she has over 3 million Instagram followers. She's really developed a social media following because she's such an expert and she's so passionate about diet and nutrition. She wrote The Galveston Diet, a three-prong lifestyle plan best-selling book, and now, even more amazing, the new menopause book, which is such a comprehensive science-based approach to how women need to approach going through this journey. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell me all about you. I mean, I think this is fascinating that you started as a traditional OB-GYN, very, very much going down the road of everyday medicine, and then you very much switched tracks. Is it because of what your patients were going through and what you noticed in the field?
I think I was in a large academic institution. I was a generalist OBGYN. I also was a residency program director and super proud of the work I did and what we were teaching, what I was learning. But as I was approaching my own menopause and my patients were aging with me, I started realizing that there was a tremendous gap in what we were funneling down to our residents and learners about care of the woman after reproduction ends and how, it seems like all of women's health is dumped in the lap of the poor, busy obstetrician gynecologist. Outside, and then once we're done with reproduction, outside of the need for a hysterectomy or, ovarian cancer or something faulty with your uterus, no one is kind of looking after our health as menopausal people as far as, how we are having increasing risk of cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis. And there's just was kind of this like nod to menopause, like, yeah, it's tough, but you'll get through it. And not really focusing on all the estrogen receptors in our body and what estrogen deprivation does. And I thought, we are really not serving my population now and just past reproduction. And I think that I can spread the message and do something about it on a large scale.
Oh my gosh, I so agree with you. I feel like their entire subspecialties related to obstetrics and delivery and textbooks on obstetrics. And then there's textbooks for gynecology, gynecologic cancers. But then I was
Surgery.
in school, there was no menopause textbook, nothing
There's
was
like
taught.
maybe a whisper of a chapter or a link, like in our ABOG, which American Board of OB-GYN, the recertification articles I read every month. There's not even a category for menopause. Like
Oh,
NIH,
shocking.
there's no category for menopause. It's just like this siloed, shoved in. When you look at NIH funding in women's health, 0.03% goes to menopause. I'm like, wait, more women will become menopausal than will have babies. And we're just kind of like brushing, how we're different than our male counterparts under the table. And this is bigger than just ovarian failure. This is the gender health gap. Like, we're not studying women in large scale. We're not, looking at cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and how there's a very gender specific way we present with these diseases. We die from these diseases. We're treated with these diseases. They need to disaggregate the data. So, this, what started out was, these hot flashes are really terrible. I need to do something about it. Has really blossomed to a much bigger picture of inequity in healthcare.
Do you envision a day when there'll be a whole subsection of menopause like specialists? Because we're
I do.
almost in a void where you have your OB-GYN and then you finished having your babies. Maybe you had your, uterus partially removed from a fibroid, whatever, and then nobody's there to take care of you. Your internist doesn't quite want the responsibility, and there's a void.
There seems to be a void, and I don't think it should be dumped in the lap of the OB-GYN. They're busy enough doing gynecology and obstetrics, but that women's health, the health of women outside of reproduction really should be a subspecialty, and that we're more than just small men with reproductive organs, right? There's so much different about our brains and our hearts and our bones and, how we thrive or don't thrive with the presence or absence of these sex hormones.
So true. And then you mentioned how estrogen receptors are everywhere. Where are some areas that people don't even realize that estrogen hits and has influence? I know the brain is a huge one.
Brain is huge. So much of why women suffer from dementia at much higher rate than men is due to the loss of estrogen in menopause. and probably testosterone. And we know progesterone is very, very mental health. We have a 40% increase in mental health disorders through the menopause transition. We have doubling rate of SSRI use across the menopause transition. So that's just the brain. Heart palpitations, now a known vasomotor response to, you know, palpitations are part of it. How many women are rushing to the ER thinking they have, told they have a panic attack, you know, palpitations, $1 million workup, going home with a Holter monitor. You know, some of that is indicated, but all of this was just menopause and how her body reacted. What blows up the internet for me is when I talk about things like the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause and frozen shoulder. You know, in your line of work, we lose 30% of our collagen in our skin, which, yes, has huge cosmetic implications, but also leads to poor wound healing and, you know, less healthy skin through the first 5 years of menopause. 30%.
Wow. Yeah. The skin implications are huge. I mean, I deal with aesthetics and skin, and loss of collagen is dramatic. It's almost like it happens overnight. The skin locks you. Like one day you wake up, you look in the mirror and you have your mother's neck and you're like, what is going on with me? It's that loss of elasticity, skin turgor, all these changes that happen. Now,
estrogen receptors, we have, of course, our liver. So cholesterol goes up, no changes in diet and exercise. You will have decrease in your HDL, rise in the bad levels of LDL. You will have increasing triglycerides for a lot of patients. Our bones begin to deteriorate at accelerated rates outside of just aging. We have shunting of fat to the viscera. Premenopausal patients age matched have about 8% of their body fat is visceral. Fast forward to menopause, we're now at 23%.
Wow.
The diet and exercise. So not only is this like cosmetic implications and the kind of fires of menopause where you're not functioning, you know, short term, but this is leading to acceleration of our rates of chronic disease. So at the end of the day, women live a little bit longer than men, but we're spending 20% of our lifespan in poorer health than our male counterparts. Double the rate of admission, 3 to 1 rate of admission into nursing homes.
Wow.
3 to 1 rate of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
We have much higher rates of frailty and decline. And so, you know, when my patients come to me in menopause clinic, of course we put out the fires. We fix the, you know, we fix the hot flashes, the brain fog, the sexual libido, all that stuff. Then we set a course for the next 30 years of her life. And I'm like, what do you want? She goes, well, you know, my mom has dementia. My mom has frailty. I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. Or I'm like, look, if your mom's 90 and cooking and cleaning and taking care of herself and really, really functional and has lived this beautiful life, let's just do what she did. Let's mm-hmm. do this. Okay. But that's not most families. Mm-hmm. Most, you know, women, especially the oldest women in the family, like me, are having to make the end of life decisions and care for these women who are requiring much longer times of disability and disease and chronic illness versus the dads. The dads just kind of live pretty functional and then have a very quick decline and die.
Mm-hmm.
Women are having this protracted long course of disability mm-hmm. and is what my patients are fighting against.
Wow. So I'm going to reverse to the part where you say you correct their hot flashes, you correct all their brain fog, you correct all that. Take us there. So what should we be talking to our OB-GYN doctors about? Because that's all we have right now. We don't have any menopause specialists.
Yeah.
What do we ask for?
One certified menopause specialist from the Menopause Society for every 33,000 women in the U.S. right now.
Oh my gosh. That's insanity. Exactly. We need to go to Washington and petition.
Residency program director, I'm well versed in the curriculum, and there is very, very little clinically significant menopause education that happens in training. It's just kind of forgotten.
There's not even any conferences. Like, let's say I really wanted to dive deep as a physician. No one's built, you need to build some.
There is now the Menopause Society, North American Menopause Society, which is rebranded to Menopause Society, has been around, but it's not well known. So one of the things that I've been proud to do is kind of elevate them and talk about them on podcasts. And that's where I was certified in menopause. So, you know, is it perfect? No, but it's definitely a step in the right direction, is recognizing menopause for the entity that it actually is. And
so let's start at the beginning. How does a patient know if they're in a perimenopause versus menopause?
So let's go through all the definitions. We sadly define menopause, this is terrible, by the presence or absence of a period. Mm. And that's just a symptom of menopause, is the loss of a period. What's happening is the loss of ovarian function. So what if you've had a hysterectomy? What if you have a Mirena IUD and you don't have periods? What if you've had an ablation? What if you don't have regular periods? You get left behind often in the diagnosis tree. And so medically, we define currently, and we're fighting to change it, that menopause is 1 year after your final menstrual period. That's it. That is one day in your life. Everything after that is postmenopause. So menopause never ends. Okay. We are always dealing in some fashion with loss of our sex hormone production from the ovaries. Perimenopause is the transition state. So why does this happen? Female mammals are born with all of our egg supply, different than males. Males in the testicles make a factory fresh every day. We, as inside of our mother's wombs, as the ovary cells are formed, they're frozen in meiosis one, which you know and I know, but you know, kind of frozen in like a separation period until puberty. And then the whole completion of the gametes being formed happens with each ovulation. Well, so we're born with about 1 to 2 million eggs. Plenty, right? For a lifetime. Nope. We start deteriorating. And with each ovulation process, we lose about 10,000 just to get one egg out.
Wow.
And so by the time we're 30, females are down to about 10% of their egg supply. By the time we're 40, we're down to a roughly 3%. Perimenopause represents a critical egg threshold level where the signal is coming from the brain. So in our brain, you know, it's the hypothalamus has a little finger in the blood supply checking for estrogen levels. When estrogen get low, it sends the GnRH, sends a signal to the pituitary saying, hey, estrogen's low, we need more estrogen. Pituitary says, got it, boss. Pumps out LH and FSH, which leads to ovulation. Very simplified, right? And in a premenopausal woman, this ebb and flow natural of hormone cycles looks like an EKG each month. Very predictable. Day 14, you do this. 28, you do this, blah, blah, blah. And it goes on and on and on until we reach that low level that the engine light comes on and the ovary can't respond to that normal LH and FSH. It doesn't have enough juice left, not enough gas. So the brain gets mad and says, where's my estrogen? Sends a signal to the pituitary. Pituitary says, fine. It sends a bigger burst of FSH down. We got to get this egg out. So it takes extra time to get that ovulation to happen. And then because of that bunch of FSH, the ovary freaks out, sometimes double ovulates, which is why we see twins more when women are older. And we see higher levels of estrogen than we ever did in our premenopausal years and bigger drops. So it used to look, and then progesterone in the post-ovulatory phase never kind of gets up to where it used to be in your normal reproductive years. So what that looks like on a day-to-day basis is chaos. The brain is bouncing signals around, fighting to get the ovulation to happen. The ovary's doing its best. It's throwing out estrogen, then crashing progesterone. So we lose that predictability. Perimenopause is when you used to be able to say what was happening, you never, ever know. Now, physically, we see this is when we begin to see the hot flashes, when we begin to see the mental health changes, when the brain hates chaos and it's directly affecting our neuroreceptors. We start seeing joint pain. We start seeing gut changes. We definitely start seeing inflammation levels rise, even though your periods really haven't started to get irregular yet. And it's a really frustrating time for patients because they know something's not right, but they can't figure out what's going on because none of us were ever taught.
It is interesting.
Postmenopause is easy. You don't have periods and it's a one-time blood test, super easy. But because of the chaos in perimenopause, we don't have a good blood test for it. So often in my world and people who are like interested in menopause care and have gone outside the box for training, it is a diagnosis of exclusion. So I'm doing a lot of blood work, looking at hypothyroidism and autoimmune disease and inflammation markers, just to make sure I'm not missing anything.
I think that's crazy that we have so much variability. Is there like a quiz or something that a patient can take to kind of grade themselves and like figure out where they are?
Yeah. In 2008, the Green Scale was published and it just never got propagated. Like very few people use it, but I have it. And it is really just looking at symptoms and severity and being able to give a predictability score. What's the likelihood that your symptoms are related to perimenopause? I have it on my website. So to my LinkedIn bio and attached to that is a free empowerment guide, how to find a doctor, what questions to ask, what to prepare for your appointment. I want to give people as many tools as possible because unfortunately as females, we have to be CEO of our own healthcare, CEO of our own menopause, because lack of training and education, the lack of focus on us post-reproduction is leading to you to kind of have to educate yourself, sometimes educate your provider and really fight to get the best healthcare for you.
That's so true. I think when doctors graduate from med school, they're stuck with this bank of knowledge. They finish residency and that's it. They maxed out. They maybe go to a CME meeting here and there, but they are relying on like, you know, really 30, 40 year old knowledge, and they're not staying cutting edge and, you know, pushing the envelope of patient care. So it is dependent on patients. As CEO, I nominate that we change the name, the branding, the word menopause. I just hate it. It just has so many negative connotations. It's just like, and in some ways, and at age 50, when women are going through these changes, is when they feel the most empowered about their lives, right? And their second and their new ideas.
This should be a time not of decline and decay. This should be us rocking our worlds. Like the kids are grown for so many of us. I mean, certainly we're all in different levels, but like we should be leaning into our power, leaning into like our most productive, our wisdom, everything we built. It's time to share. And what's happening is some of these symptoms, one out of five women in the UK is leaving their job at an upper level position because they are not able to manage their work responsibilities because their symptoms are so severe and they're not being addressed. It's the economic impact, the financial impact of this is huge. And because we're not training our healthcare providers, they're misdiagnosing, or so the patients are getting polypharmacy, they're getting metoprolol for their palpitations, they're getting, you know, SSRIs for their depression. They're getting, instead of someone like connecting all the dots and realizing this is what her sex hormone deprivation is doing to her, if we just give her back the natural hormones she made, we actually can solve a lot of these problems and then we can focus on what's left behind.
Honestly, like this is the phase where so many of my patients, like you said, the kids are gone to school. They're inspired to restart all their interests. They no longer have fear about, you know, they're very confident in who they are. It should be like the woman on fire phase of life, like, you know, instead of like
It
hot
can be.
flashes.
It really can be. Like, you know, not 100% of us will choose hormone therapy or will feel like they need it or are candidates, but we're denying women the choice and the conversation around it due to old data and fear. And that has got to stop. That's my mission.
So that old data, let's talk a little bit about hormone replacement therapy, because yes, old data has influenced our health choices, and we've been, you know, told that estrogens are going to give us breast cancer and we should all like back away. So can you go over what the misconceptions are and how estrogens generally are very safe?
So estrogen therapy, you know, there was a landmark study done. The first round was stopped in 2002. And looking at, does hormone therapy in the form of an estrogen, which was Premarin at the time, plus a progestogen, which was medroxyprogesterone acetate, not really used much anymore. We knew that it helped with hot flashes and everything. That wasn't an endpoint, but does it really help with heart disease? We knew from observational data that women on HRT tended to die less from heart attacks and have less cardiovascular disease age per age matched. Is that an artifact of healthy, wealthy women get HRT versus regular, you know, women who can't afford it, or is this real? So the average age of the WHA study was 63 years old. Okay, much, much older, 13 years older than the average woman starting hormone therapy for menopause symptoms. They did have, you know, a wide range of ages, but it was a much older population because the endpoint was heart disease. What they noticed in 2002, a couple of years in, you know how long it takes to develop breast cancer? They noticed that the women who were taking estrogen plus the progestogen had a slight increased risk of breast cancer compared to women who were taking estrogen alone and placebo. The estrogen alone arm actually had a 30% decreased relative risk of breast cancer. So remember that. So they called a press conference before the results were released. These three dudes got up and said, estrogen is dangerous, causes breast cancer. We stopped the study, da, 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 whatever. And it was the number one news story, medical news story of 2002. Front page of every newspaper. Before social media and things went viral, this went viral. Okay, I remember I was a chief resident at the time, and we were using hormone therapy for only about 40% of patients and recommending it for cardiovascular benefit and hot flashes and osteoporosis and all the things. And it just abruptly stopped. Like everyone was terrified. The doctors were terrified. And even though multiple aspects of the study and those findings have been walked back and published by the authors, those were not publicized, right? And that information wasn't propagated. The boards, the colleges were not presenting this information as CME for our providers. So everyone's like stuck in 2002. And so enter Gen X, who is not putting up with this stuff. And, you know, Avram Blooming writing, you know, Carol Tarvis writing Estrogen Matters, Howard Hodes presenting, you know, the cardiovascular disease literature, the American Heart Association in 2020 publishing, wait a minute, younger women in menopause are having cardiovascular benefit. It's the older patients that aren't seeing benefit because they already have heart disease. estrogen is better at prevention than cure. So, and then no one talks about obesity is a way higher risk factor for patients than hormone replacement therapy would ever be considered. And it wasn't the estrogen, it was that particular progestogen. So for the vast majority of patients, now the Menopause Society in 2022 rewrote the guidelines and said, for the majority of patients under the age of 60, the benefits will outweigh the risks for hormone replacement therapy. And after the age of 60, it is a nuanced conversation, and there is no age at which you must stop hormone replacement therapy. It is when, for her individually, this is personalized precision medicine, the benefits, as long as the benefits outweigh the risks and she wants it, she is welcome to stay on it.
Wow. Okay. Everyone under 60 who's listening, take notes, because you need to take this information to your OB-GYN doctor, because it's probably not out there.
This is published American Heart Association. This is published in the Menopause Society. This is all available information. I have it on my website for you to print out and take to your doctor. So
I literally need to do that, because there are many very good, very reputable, you know, physicians, internists, and primary care doctors out there who do not read literature and also don't change their ways because they pass the boards with one set of protocols. And I think it's so important. You mentioned like hormone therapy. So there's the other controversy. Do we do bioidentical or not bioidentical? Do we do pellets, patches, creams?
And a great question. And I love talking about this. So, you know, in this kind of absence, this vacuum of menopause care, women are desperate. Okay. And I think some well-meaning clinicians kind of found a niche for themselves offering hormone therapy. And God bless Suzanne Summers, who set the whole world on fire with bioidentical. So bioidentical kind of was a marketing term and never a medical term. So we have to be careful of the language we use. So I try to use the proper chemical names, right? And so bioidentical means chemically identical to what your body made. So that in the ovary is estradiol, is progesterone, and is testosterone, just like that. Okay, those words. Now, there are synthetic forms of those, good, bad, ugly, whatever, but most of us in modern contemporary menopause care use those formulations. We have seen coming out of the Danish trial, like all the trials coming out of Europe, that women on estradiol seem to do the best, better than the synthetic forms. But though Premarin is not synthetic, it comes from pregnant mare urine. I have ethical issues with that. It's dozens of different estrogen derivatives. You know, I'd rather just stick to estradiol. It's kind of what your body's used to. And most experts would agree. So most of us do use the bioidentical preparations. Where the confusion is there was this misunderstanding, and sometimes led by certain members of the medical community, that the only way to get bioidentical was through compounding. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. So you can get safe, efficacious, affordable, like very inexpensive bioidentical care through an estradiol patch or pill, through oral micronized progesterone, total combined cost of maybe $35 a month. Now you may have to hustle and use a coupon and, you know, go to a couple different pharmacies. It happens. And so here are these kind of niche practices being set up to offer hormone therapy to women, but like kind of forcing them to go to these compounding pharmacies and it's the best and you'll never get cancer, which, you know, I'm not going to say a woman's never going to get cancer, right? But, you know, making them feel like they're getting this elite form of hormone replacement therapy that is safer and more natural and everything, when literally you don't have to pay that much money and go through compounding, which is not regulated. So, you know, getting a steady state dose and getting the exact same thing every month when you go pick up your creams, your troches or whatever is difficult for any compounding pharmacy to do. And so those of us, you know, practicing evidence-based medicine are really sticking to the FDA formulations first. Love having compound for backup or when what I need is not available. But, you know, most of us can do probably 95% of care using bioidentical formulations available at a pharmacy. Testosterone's a little bit different. Not FDA approved for women outside of transitioning to female to male transitions, right? And so, but we know for postmenopausal patients, it works very well for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And there's anecdotal evidence coming out that, you know, we know we have testosterone receptors everywhere, that it's probably good for bones and muscles and everything else, but I'm sticking to the HSDD indication. And, you know, some of us struggle in certain states on getting, and it's controlled substance. So you know, I did compounding testosterone for a long time. I finally was able to find a pharmacy that's letting me prescribe prescribe Androgel to my patients. So I've got an FDA approved formulation. We're using half a pump and then we're titrating from that, you know, for my patients. So the medications are out there. Unfortunately, finding the doctors, finding the trained doctors, finding the ones willing to prescribe is a little bit of the Underground Railroad right now. Mm-hmm. Who do you know? Who did this for you? And then finding it affordable is a struggle for a lot of women.
Do you think testosterone is something that we should all think about incorporating?
I think it's a discussion worth having. Absolutely. If you're having hypoactive sexual desire disorder, so female sexual dysfunction, where we've ruled out orgasmic disorder, arousal disorder, pain, it's a complicated conversation, but one that doctors aren't trained to have outside of sexual medicine, and OB-GYN is not sexual medicine. And there's two other FDA-approved medications, Addy and Vyleesi, for premenopausal patients, and we're using them off-label for postmenopausal patients who are struggling with HSDD. These are patients who have a great relationship with their partner. They're not having pain. They can orgasm. They don't have an arousal disorder. There's just the neurotransmitter in the brain is not lining up to make them receptive to the stimulus. And it's so frustrating for them because they miss it. They used to have it. They want it back. And this is where this class of medications can be really helpful.
So that's so interesting. Now you talk a little bit in your Galveston diet book about the various nutritional things that we could be doing or behavioral things that can improve that transition into menopause. So intermittent fasting, are you still recommending that?
And then less. Boy, I was hardcore fan of intermittent fasting when I first like read all the data and got into it. And I still think there's definitely a part of it. Where I was struggling was my focus has shifted on thin to strong. The more I learned about longevity and longevity through menopause, it's more about muscle and bone strength than about any march to be skinny. And a lot of times we're sacrificing bone and muscle to be thin. Mm-hmm. And so since I've changed that mindset, I realize I'm not eating enough protein. Same, you know, looking at the WHI data, which is a great data set. You know, I don't want to demonize all the hard work these researchers did. We have beautiful data coming out of WHI. One of the things was they looked at frailty. Mm-hmm. In older women and protein intake. And it turns out it's 1.6 grams for every kilogram of lean body mass. FDA is recommending 0.8. It is double. So I needed to like dramatically increase my protein intake to maintain my muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling to do that in an 8-hour window. I was literally walking around with a chicken breast all day chewing on it. And so, and you know, I don't like to do a lot of supplements if I don't have to. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to give myself 2 more hours to eat more protein. And so now I probably fast 12 hours a day, no problem. Yeah. And the benefits there, but I'm really more focused on eating more and not less. And can I tell you, it is so much better of a way to live.
You feel less edgy. I feel a little less edgy too. I'm totally like you. I'm walking around with the protein shake all the time. Yeah. All the protein
like bar. I got my little bars and
yes. Yeah, it's so important, I think. But I think I love the intermittent fasting because it did teach me how to respect my hunger signals. Like I'm not really eating till I just feel like I need to eat something.
Yeah. So it's really more about intuitive eating, you know, at this point. If I'm hungry, I eat. You know, if I didn't have a great dinner or just kind of felt off the night before, I'm going to eat breakfast if I'm hungry. I'm not going to worry about it. Right?
Exactly. I love that. Throw away the rule book. But in menopause, we do develop sort of this very centripetal, visceral body fat, rectangular habitus, and it becomes very, very challenging to lose that midsection fat. Are there things you can do for that?
Right. So I scoured the evidence and I found a few core principles. Actually, a couple of times a year, and I'm about to start one right after Labor Day. I do this like, I have it right here, the Belly Fat Blast Challenge. It's like free and it's just habits. Okay. That who do these consistently tend to have less body fat. So first one is fiber intake. And I bet 90% of your patients have never looked at fiber in their diet. Mm. Women consistently consume more than 25 grams of fiber in their diet and mostly for food, right? I'm not talking about just take Metamucil all day. That's not going to help. Have less visceral fat, decrease the rate at which they're storing visceral fat. So that's like the first thing. Another rule of 25 is women who consistently have less than 25 grams of added sugar in their diet per day, not total sugars, but the sugars added in cooking and processing. Mm. And so the fruits, vegetables, the sugars naturally found in dairy, those are okay. But when you limit the sugars you put in your coffee and your condiments and your drinks, you know, things that are at or in alcohol, and you keep that less than 25, not to say you can never have a brownie or a cookie, you have a budget, right? And you get to pick and choose where those sugars go. Women have much less visceral fat. exercise, you know, we need to move our bodies. And so I try to meet my patients where they are. If they're sedentary, we just start walking. You know, I don't get to is HIIT better or you got more cortisol. Well, I'm like, move your body. Move your body every day.
Get out of your chair.
That's superior as movement of any type. And so, you know, and then once they get to a certain level, then we see how can we tweak this? What can we add? When do we start lifting? You know, but for me to tell a sedentary patient to all of a sudden start lifting is probably a mistake. She needs to start walking and then we can, you know, get that to be a habit. And then we start adding in some of the resistance training from there. Mm-hmm. So part of the belly fat challenge is doing 150 minutes a week of about zone two cardio. So zone two, like if you can talk, but it's a little bit of a struggle, you're pretty much in zone two, but we have little heart rate calculators to help them, you know, measure it if they wear their watches and they want to really track it. Third is really self-care. So it's stress reduction and figuring out what works for you. I can't say everyone must meditate or journal or, you know, I'm like, is it calling a bestie? Is it watching a movie? Is it whatever? But like, you need to carve out time for yourself every day where you are shutting out the world and just focusing on the present, whatever that looks like for you. It could be prayer. It could be, you know, anything, but like taking that time for yourself, putting your oxygen mask on first, mm-hmm. you know, and then, you know, grounding, touching grass, all that stuff is real, you know, and it all can help and contribute to decreasing those cortisol levels. And then alcohol. So it's a 30-day challenge for no alcohol. And for some patients, that's a struggle. You know, they're social drinkers. They love that glass of wine with dinner or whatever. And so women who have lower alcohol consumption have less belly fat. It's just one of the things that kind of contributes to that as well. So those are the five kind of key things for patients to start with.
I love it. You're making it so easy for us. It's like very much something you can integrate with your lifestyle. What are your thoughts on the semaglutide craze?
I'm a fan in the right patient. Again, all medications have risks, benefits. And what I think is happening is, you know, it is a craze and that it's readily available sometimes from providers, clinicians who are not really trained. And so I do have patients on semaglutides and they are doing beautifully, beautifully if they tolerate it. Again, not everybody's going to tolerate it due to side effects. And then we are combining it with the protein intake, the resistance training. Look, so for these people on semaglutide, of course, we're walking first, but then we are really aggressive to add in resistance training because our focus is not to sacrifice muscle to get to a number on the scale. And with caloric restriction, which tends to happen with semaglutide because you're slowing down the rate of emptying your stomach and you're decreasing those hunger cues, you tend to eat less. And what you are eating, we really have to focus on and make sure we're getting good nutrition. But the change here, which is always the message I gave before, was there's something about the GLP-1s that are giving them the headspace to be able to follow through with the lifestyle changes. And I've never seen it happen in such a large scale before. So they are getting the habits down that are going to keep them healthy longer, which is the ultimate goal.
That's so true. I think it does take away the food noise. One of our mutual friends, Dr. Danielle Bilardo, has taught me so much about semaglutides, and I'm a huge fan of that. But do you think that they are going to improve fertility outcomes?
In the PCOS patients, more than likely, obesity is a risk for infertility, and definitely PCOS and visceral fat, abdominal fat go hand in hand because of the insulin resistance problem. You know, most PCOS is actually insulin resistance. It's just how the ovaries responding to that. In your body. I'm a thin PCOS patient, went through the whole fertility gamut, everything. So GLP-1s would have never helped me. I didn't have a weight problem, but you know, I ended up going on metformin and, you know, all the things that's kind of old school, you know, 90s medicine, but I do understand those struggles and frustrations that those patients go through.
Are there changes in gut health that happen as we enter menopause? You talked about fiber being important, but what else happens to the gut?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked. So the Zoe Predict study, which is a large scale nutrition study that came out of the UK, they had thousands of patients and they actually, thank you, Jesus, tracked them through their menopause transition. They were doing stool samples and, you know, and what they found was a woman's gut microbiome changes to that of a man's through the
God, you're kidding.
Wow. So, amount and diversity changes. There's a gut estrobilome. So how we metabolize estrogen metabolites in the gut, and some of them get reactivated to estradiol and then reabsorbed. And so all of that is kind of emerging research and it's so, 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 so fascinating. But beyond the shadow of a doubt, our gut health, our gut, you know, diversity changes through menopause, and HRT does seem to be, you know, giving your body back that natural estrogen does seem to attenuate those changes.
So fascinating. How about the new craze with putting your vaginal cream on your face? Have you heard
So
of
topical estrogen. So
Yes.
vaginal estrogen cream is low dose estradiol cream, typically 0.01%.
Yes.
And it's a miracle for genital urinary syndrome and menopause, both prevention and cure. There were studies kind of done before the WHI in the 90s looking at topical estriol cream, the exact same formulation as what we put in our vagina, and estriol cream, which is bioidentical, but it's made in the placenta. And they both had similar efficacy and safety. Local estrogen, whether put on the vagina or put on the face, does not absorb to any significant degree into our system. So it's very, very, very safe as far as worries about activating a tumor caused by, estrogen-fed tumor. But then the study stopped and the discussion stopped after WHI because estrogen was bad. Well, now that a generation has passed and Gen Xers aren't putting up with this, interest in the medications has resumed. So women started putting their vaginal estrogen on their face. The problem with it is vaginal estrogen is alcohol-based and it dries the skin and people don't like the consistency. So some like compounding pharmacies are formulating it with a more moisturizing base. So it's better for the skin. I'm using estriol and they did that safety efficacy. They did all the blood tests. They followed the patients. It's very, very, very safe and it's in a moisturizing base. So I'm a huge fan. It showed, the biopsies were showing increasing not only collagen, but elastin as well in the pre and post treatment patients. So I think it's pretty promising. We can't stop time. We're all aging, but it does seem to attenuate to a decent degree some of the menopausal associated skin changes. I'm also putting it like on the back of my hands, which are really thin now, and really under my eyes, which is super thin for me. I have deep set eyes. So
That's cool. Are you noticing some changes or improvements?
I do everything. So, for me, it's preventative. I laser and I have great skincare and I sunscreen and I do retinol. So,
Yay, I'm proud of you. Good. You're doing all
like, I am like, yes to everything.
right. Are you yes to Botox and fillers? Are
Of
you?
course,
Oh,
yes.
okay, great. Yeah, I think you have to like you look smooth and maintained, but very natural. Fabulous. You're just gorgeous inside and out. I'm also curious about your thoughts on just in general, like the philosophy. I feel like old school medicine is very much like, your hormones peak, you do your reproductive thing, and it's normal for everything to you just sort of taper off and shut down as you age.
In menopause, I mean, in medicine, normal means common. It's not that it's okay or it's healthy, right? It's normal to lose your eyesight. It's normal to have erectile dysfunction. And there's so many things in medicine that are normal parts of aging that we treat, including heart disease and cardiovascular disease. Why is women's quality of life, sex life, health, bone health, brain health, so neglected, why are we siloing women to one organ system? It's ridiculous. I think it's old school, it's paternalistic, and it is not serving the health of women as we age.
It's so true, but it's
Now,
almost like
you may
marrying.
choose not to take it. You can be healthy without hormone therapy. Let me be clear. It's not
Yeah.
mandatory, but it's harder. And for some women, it's very, very hard.
Talk a
So
little bit about that. I think hot flashes being like the most crazy symptom you can't control.
80% of women have musculoskeletal syndrome, but you blame it on other things, right? You
Okay.
can't blame a hot flash on anything else. So
Right.
that is why the hot flash became the poster child, other than a fever or tuberculosis, and we can rule those out, right? And so hot flashes became the poster child and the only recognizable symptom of menopause. Forever, all the research on HRT was done to stop a hot flash,
Right.
And so I think that is a disservice to women. Hot flashes are massively important, huge sleep disruptor, massive changes in quality of life, my own included. And a hot flash is the bell ringer for cardiovascular disease risk and stroke risk. So let me be clear, if you have severe hot flashes, you are much higher risk for those diseases.
And what can we do to stop that? My God, they just come up on you like you don't even know what's happening. The room is suddenly hot.
Pharmacologic options, and we have non-pharmacologic options. And so what certain medical societies in the world are saying, start with cognitive behavioral therapy, literally as first-line therapy. I'm like, because I think that a
That
hot flash
gonna
isn't going to be as bad. I'm like, no. That's not going to fix my brain or my heart or my bones. I love CBT for multiple reasons, but why are we taking something biological only in females and assigning it a psychological cause? We do this in medicine time and time and time again, that we are small men with emotions. And this has got to stop. I think it's a complete disservice to us as a gender.
Pharmacologically, are there things you're prescribing to limit
hot flashes? So, gold standard best treatment ever for hot flashes is estrogen. Replacement. That's number one. Okay. So you don't want it or you can't take it, right? You have an absolute contraindication or you just aren't interested in hormone therapy. Okay. So then we have the new class of medications are the neurokinin receptor agonists or antagonists. And so these are things like Veozah that just came out, Super Bowl commercial. So they work at the level of the hypothalamus in the brain where the neurokinin receptor is, which controls our thermostat in our bodies, which goes catawampus with the estrogen depletion and probably with the high FSH. The higher your FSH, the more likely you are to have hot flashes, regardless of what your estradiol level is. And so it blocks that receptor and seems for about 80% of the patient to modestly stabilize it. Nothing works better than estrogen. So we talk about that. Expensive, typically not yet covered by insurance because it's new. And they want you to fail multiple other medications. SSRIs work okay. A couple of them have been, one has been approved for the treatment of hot flashes. And because everyone was terrified of estrogen, when a woman goes to her doctor to complain of the classical symptoms of menopause, hot flashes, only 15% are offered any treatment at all. And 4 to 1, it was an SSRI for 20 something years.
Wow. That's a shame. That's a sad shame.
That's kind of where we are. We talk about clonidine. We talk about gabapentin. You know, those are modest. Okay. For years on my breast cancer patients, I was doing gabapentin. Now we have Veozah, which works better than that. But, you know, Veozah is new and we get nervous about long-term data. And so it was never tested in a breast cancer patient anyway. So it's a problem. It's a problem.
And how do you spell Veozah?
Veozah. Veozah.
Okay.
Veozah. Yeah.
So something else people can try. How about in the biohacking realm of taking peptides, NMN, have you been doing NAD or anything
I've been
like that?
Looking, you know, I read David Sinclair's book and I tried NAD and NMN and stopped doing it. And then Atea came out. Nah, those don't work. So, you know, I just, whatever. But there's interest in medicine. Some great research is going into extending the life of the ovary. Now, too late for me and maybe you. Like once you're depleted of eggs, they don't regenerate. They're gone, right?
Yeah.
Nothing left. So I'm not going to grow back a liver or my ovary. But for our daughters, there is hope that we can, for fertility purposes and delaying menopause for health reasons, new pharmacologics are being developed to possibly decrease the decline of the egg supply so that we can have estrogen longer.
I love that. There is some research that says that NMN or NAD increased production can improve oocyte viability or extend.
No, but you have to start really young.
I start young, yeah.
Yeah. So like probably once you're down to 3%, I don't know how much good you're going to do.
At age 40, it's too late. Yes. So this is a message out there for all. What is there a message out there for fertility minded women? Because everybody's delaying getting pregnant longer and longer until they're 35.
I totally get it. I had my babies at 32 and 35. I didn't realize I had PCOS until I was in medical school, you know, like, and then went through the drama and the drugs and the testing and the tears and, you know, finally got the babies and it's a lot. And so, you know, I'm just telling my daughters, your period is a vital sign. Mm-hmm. And if you're not having regular monthly periods, you mm-hmm. need to find somebody who cares and start talking about why that's happening and get to the root cause, you know, so that you can maintain your fertility. We know lots of things that will make us go through menopause faster, a hysterectomy. Leave your ovaries behind, you lose 4 years on the shelf life of your ovaries. Radiation, smoking, poor diet, low exercise, like all of the pillars of health mm-hmm. will affect the life of the ovary. Trauma, stress. Like someone actually looked at this data, which astounded me, that women who were sexually abused, who then had daughters who were sexually abused, go through menopause 9 years sooner. They become premature ovarian failure.
Oh.
It's trauma related. So that's really people who bothered to look at this. And can you imagine, like, women who live in high stress environments go through menopause sooner?
Wow.
If you're underweight. And so birth control pills, like suppressing ovulation, does tend to extend the life. Just, you know, probably not super clinically significant, but you do tend to get a little more life out of the ovary. But it really is. I wouldn't take birth controls for that reason at all.
Mm-hmm. For young people on the pill, any words of advice or wisdom?
No, I was on the pill for years. I have two daughters who are managing their own contraceptive, you know, journeys. and their own gynecologic journeys. And so, you know, I think we're not doing a great job counseling. I think it's a great medication. It's got multiple uses. And certainly if you don't want to be pregnant, it can be a viable option for you, but it does, you know, it does seem to change something in the gut microbiome. It does seem to change, your definitely is decreasing your sex drive because you're decreasing your testosterone production from the ovary. You know, those things can be big concerns. My newlyweds, you know, first getting on the pill, we're like hitting the struggle bus, you know, with desire at 25, you know, things are supposed to be, and you just got married. And so, you know, new to contraception. So those are the things we kind of watch for. We discuss ahead of time. And I don't think those conversations are happening.
That's so true. I have three daughters also. That's just very challenging to even know what to advise them anymore. But they need a great OB-GYN like you, who's so knowledgeable. So where can people find you on your Instagram and other handles and definitely get all those resources?
DrMaryClaire, Dr. Mary Claire everywhere, or Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Our website is The Pause Life. So I'm trying to build it into this magical encyclopedia full of blogs and information and just how to go to download this, click that, full of resources, all free, available for people to help navigate this journey because we need help.
We do need help. And I can't wait to get your book and read all about it. So you have two books. One is The Galveston Diet and the other one, The New Menopause.
New Menopause.
Yeah, you guys have to check it out. I'm sure it's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been there for a little while, right?
We're almost at 17 weeks. So yeah.
Wow, that's a great accomplishment. So you're reaching all these people. That's really impressive. So thank you so much, Dr. Mary Claire Haver. And the advice you've given is so important for all of our women out there listening to really look at your estrogen levels. And I think if there's any one piece of advice you want to leave them with, what's that?
You know, menopause is inevitable. None of us, if we're lucky to live long enough, are going to get out of it at this point, but suffering is not. And, you know, educate, inform yourself, empower yourself. You are the CEO of your own healthcare.
Love it. That's so a beautiful thought to end on. That's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, doing amazing things with people's faces, health, and longevity. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.